Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome into Bartholomew Town's continuing coverage of the impact of COVID-19 here in Rhode Island. I'm Bill Bartholomew. On this episode, wrapping up restaurant week here on the pod with a one and only Dante Bellini Jr. I figured, you know, it's restaurant week, so the only sensible way, restaurant week here on Bartholomew Town, the only sensible way to wrap up the week would be to discuss the podcast that we're doing together. To start with, anyway, that's essentially 100% about the restaurant community here in the state, the Fill-In Guys, which anyone out there who's listening right now who isn't familiar, it's a new series. We're two episodes deep right now that Dante and I go to Roadie Classic restaurants with Roadie Classic characters and hear some great stories, kind of fill in some of the missing conversations that aren't necessarily happening. Not anyone's fault, but well, I guess just circumstance would make it that there's not, you know, Channel 12 isn't necessarily doing this. We'll put it that way, what we're doing. And so it's nice to create this kind of content while they're busy chasing ambulances and misbehaving politicians, to say the least. So good morning, sir. And
good morning, William.
Looking great.
As I've said off the air, you're nicely coiffed.
Why, thank you. Thank you. Yes. I feel energized. It's good. I've started this new protein shake thing over the last month or so, which is nice. Oh, you throw a banana in there. I'm feeling like, am I turning into a health guy? You know, maybe next thing I'll be Ed Fitzpatrick out here, get running 18 miles a day, or more than anything. His wife actually is the real runner.
She has run, I think, approaching 800 days in a row, at least 1 mile.
That's wild. Yeah, I'm not going to be that. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, that is a goal I do not wish to attain.
Well, you know, it's obviously this is probably the toughest time for the restaurant industry thus far that I can imagine, and certainly some innovations are occurring in which several places are open, sustaining at some level. But what's your gut right now? Are we in a position where restaurants, Rhode Island's restaurant institutions, can sustain for the long term based on the approach that we're kind of in right now with the governor's reopening phase one, phase two, and so on and so forth? Do you feel like we're going to be able to get out of this in a reasonable place?
Well, I mean, let's think about this logically, Bill. The restaurant industry, the hospitality industry contributes, I think, somewhere on the order of $300 million in taxes. To the state coffers. That is not an insignificant amount. I think it's second behind gambling. And, you know, we are a tourism-driven state. Everything that we do is somehow connected to or related to hospitality. And, you know, we're fortunate to have a really great person leading that effort. Her name is Dale Venturini. And I don't envy her position right now because she has to lead and inspire an industry that is really hurting at the moment. And, you know, I feel for all of them, but I especially feel for the smaller independent restaurateurs who are now faced with a wholesale shift in how they operate. Their world changed overnight. And, you know, going from what was already a hard life, as you know, the restaurant business is not for the faint of heart. And to go from a hard existence, one that they've chosen, but nonetheless, it's hard to do what they do, to now go to a world where they have to follow very strict rules, at least in the short term, perhaps longer. and go from, you know, think about the cost and the logistics associated with plastic containers, PPE, disposable menus, thermometers, new HVAC systems, new signage. I mean, we're in already an industry where the margins are pretty slim. You know, how do all of them survive? And it's heartbreaking to know that some of them just aren't going to. And, you know, people are going to have to adapt to this if they want to stay in that business. So it's really a significant issue that both our leadership and the leadership of the hospitality industry are going to have to figure out. And then it's what people are comfortable with, us as the dining public. You know, what are we comfortable with? Are we comfortable going to these restaurants? So, you know, they have to put all the infrastructure in place, but we still have to be able to go. So takeout is nice, but I think all of us are longing for the time where we can go back in and, you know, stand at the bar, sit at a table and, you know, enjoy a night out or whatever the case may be. So the challenges are monumental. But if I know one thing about at least the restaurateurs I know, they're fighters. And, you know, my fingers are crossed.
I agree. And I think that the different approaches that are that I've seen even this week that we've highlighted here on Bartholomew Town with, you've got one place, the Galactic in Warren, that is maybe a 70-person capacity space that serves flatbreads. It's basically a bar, live music venue, but he's got actually a very legitimate and in-demand kitchen component to the service there. Now he bought juice bottles. He's bottling up his signature cocktails and he made labels and he started an ice cream takeout window that is basically going to get him through this period. You know, that's the idea anyway, rather than have a reduced, you know, 25% capacity of 70, you know, the flatbreads, that's not going to carry the business. So there is that sort of innovation happening, which is interesting.
Obviously, it's innovation, but it still requires some volume in order to make the pencil here.
Absolutely. And you look at Federal Hill right now and how is, you know, there's some businesses, I think it's the old canteen that announced, look, we're not opening until we're in a position where we can do it how we used to do, how we've always done it, indoor service. Then you have others like Venda who are really trying to utilize the outdoor space to almost replace their dining room in a way. It's going to be a real challenge. My big question is going out to dinner, wearing the mask. Evidently, Providence has made it so you can't play pre-recorded music in the background of any dining experience so that voices don't elevate beyond, you know, a whisper. So you've got the mask, you've got, you know, Dan McGowan's report in the Boston Globe, you know, you've got the plastic cutlery and so on and so forth. Is that sustainable in your mind? And are restaurants going to be able to get anything out of this from your perspective?
Well, like I said before, I think the challenges are monumental, both for the restaurateur and for the dining public. If you look at it realistically, it's no fun going into a restaurant wearing a mask and having to put the mask on, take the mask off, go to the bathroom in a restaurant and, you know, is it being cleaned? Are you cleaning it? There's just a host of issues. So everything in the hospitality industry is about the experience, right? So whether you're a hotel or a Del's Lemonade franchisee or a full operation restaurant. It's all about the customer experience. And we're not at the point where that dining experience is what we're used to. And like everything else, as a result of this pandemic, we're adjusting to a new normal. And that's, unfortunately, there's no other way to put it. So we are either going to figure it out individually. And as I said, it all comes down to what you're comfortable with, right? What you're comfortable with. And And ultimately, that is going to dictate the success and the survival of those places that you typically go to. And you mentioned Venda. Venda is probably in a little better position because, well, first, they have a longstanding business. They are in 7 different kinds of operational mode. You know, they have the grocery and they have the manufacturing and the restaurant. And so there's a lot to sort of fall back on. But I worry about, you know, the really small operators who don't have that luxury. And then I think about the innovation, you know, and those that just absolutely refuse to take the punches in the face without punching back. You know, I think about, you know, one of my favorite places, Angelo's on the Hill. I mean, just figuring out how to make takeout work. It's not ideal, but they're figuring it out. Nick Ravar at Avenue N, just doing a spectacular job keeping the brand alive, especially with the new location, and making the food the hero. Making that food look so damn good that you just want to run out and get it. Luigi's adapting to outdoor, significantly to outdoor dining. Our friends at the New York System, I mean, I'm giving you a wide variety, closing down, sort of reimagining how to do this and being able to get out there and do it. But, you know, if we were talking about the hospitality industry as this little piece of our economy, then, you know, it's a much lesser discussion. But this is a significant part of our economy. And, you know, you couple that with the loss of revenue that is now happening at, in gaming. We have a big hole to get out of. And my fingers are crossed anyway.
$900 million to be precise as of right now. And David writes in Eat, Drink, Our Eyes, David Dedakian.
And I should have mentioned David doing really, God's work out there in keeping what's important alive.
He just wrote in that music is up to the surrounding neighbors. It's a case by case deal and real cutlery is actually allowed. I don't know where, because I had seen pictures on Instagram of people using in fact, Scott Zolak, the sportscaster, the screaming Patriots color commentator. He actually tweeted out that, you know, he was at a restaurant and had regular standard issue silverware. So that's just hearsay. As far as the music, that was a prominent attorney in Providence told me that was in fact the case where the regulation was such that you couldn't have music. David's saying that's not the case, which is relieving. You know, that's obviously an absurd overreach to begin with. So just to clear that up, by the way, we're live on YouTube. So that's where these comments are coming from. If you're listening after the fact to this episode, one thing that's interesting to me as well is that I've heard from a lot of servers and other advocates here in, I guess you would call it the South Providence community. There's a lot of people who work in the delivery side or in the kitchen side. And look, let's face it, if you're on unemployment right now and you're making an extra $600 per week, it's tough to justify to yourself to return to the workforce probably and make less and put yourself at risk. I asked the governor about hazard pay for those folks, and she said something she would support if it was funded to kind of make up that $600. There's others who are saying it's your patriotic responsibility to go out and go back to work in those environments. I don't think that it's, you know, Mike Stenhouse and that whole thing. I don't think that that's an accurate assessment. I don't think it's unpatriotic. But at the same time, there's going to have to be a point here where we figure out how to do this, where people have to say, look, you know, I'm going back to my job and I'm not losing money in doing so, or at the very least, I'm not putting myself at extreme risk. So it's that investment in PPE, it's that investment in dishwashing and other cleaning mechanisms that make everybody feel comfortable. I mean,
Listen,
how expensive is that?
You know, Bill, at some point there is an intersection between what's right and what's necessary. Every individual has to figure that out for themselves. It can't be dictated by Governor Raimondo, who I think has done a pretty good job thus far. It can't be dictated by Mike Stenhouse. It can't be dictated by Nick Mattiello. it has to be dictated by your own personal sense of right and wrong and personal responsibility. And there's no other way of putting it. So if anyone's going to sit there and tell me that some 23-year-old waitress or waiter who is now making a pretty good sum by not working and because the place where they work is struggling is going to go out and make, you know, work harder to make less money, I'm going to find that a hard thing to understand or believe. And until we can get back to such time where policy, governmental policy, sort of forces the hand of us individually to get back out into the workforce, along with the better opportunity for the restaurateur to turn a profit, we're not going to get there. I mean, we were there. In many respects, we were there before March 18th or whatever the date was.
Right.
And we took a giant step backwards. So there's going to be tremendous, this is my opinion. I'm not an expert. The only thing I'm an expert in is eating, probably. But there's going to be a gigantic attrition in this industry. And there's no way to sugarcoat that. It's just going to be. And the strong are going to survive. And if there's anyone strong, it's restaurateurs, for the most part. And, you know, it's all about personal choice. You've chosen to do what you do. I've chosen to do what I do. And restaurateurs and people who run, recreational hospitality venues, they've chosen to do what they do. So at the end of the day, it's about what we want. And, you know, because we're not, and this is the part that a lot of people I think are missing, Bill. Unemployment is not going to last forever. The special $600 is not going to last forever. And there are strings attached with it. So we all have to get up off our butts and figure it out. Every one of us. None of us can sit back and say it's someone else's problem. We all have to help. And until we get to that point where we're not yelling at each other, we're not screaming at each other about who's right and who's wrong all the time, especially on that big white building on Smith Street, we're not going to figure it out. This is not a time for finger pointing. This is a time for working together. And I sincerely hope that they're going to do that.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself, and I completely agree.
You probably could have.
Well, that's debatable. Michael Cruz writes on YouTube, a job guarantee funded by the federal government, locally administered, doing good work for local communities is the only solution. It's true. I mean, again, I see a solution as, you know, if the compensation model isn't there right now because a restaurant's not turning the appropriate profit, then redirect some of that funding that's going into the $600 a month to somebody who's going out and getting back to work. I mean, that seems like an appropriate decision.
Fundamentally, Bill, let's think about this. Let's say there's that 23-year-old waiter or waitress or busboy, whoever it may be, was making $500 a week or $600 a week, and now is making $900 or $1,100 or $1,200, who in their right mind would say, I want to go back to busting my butt and making $500 less? No one. And until if you say anything that is not that, you're being disingenuous, right?
Absolutely.
So let's figure that part out, because at some point, these benefits disappear. And if we're not honest with ourselves, we're just doomed to fail.
Let's talk
And there's just one other thing.
Yeah.
It's not just the restaurants that, I mean, they're taking the hit, but it's the farms, it's the distribution channels, it's the Buffoni egg farm. Everything is affected here, all the way down the line. And so while we all understand the intellectually understand what's going on, I think that all of us have to have empathy for, you know, everyone in that chain. And it's not, and I know we're talking about restaurants, but it's not just restaurants. It's every small business that's out there. And we'll get through this. I'm absolutely positive that we'll figure out a new normal that is successful, but it's going to take some time and some pain.
Absolutely agree, 100%. Let's talk about the fill-in, guys, our show. Hey. And, you know, look at this. We were we had this idea that's now suddenly been someone threw a wrench in the middle of it. Actually, it was your idea to go out and have the Lunch and Laughs podcast where we are inside the venue where we did episode one at Olneyville, New York System. We did episode two in, I guess, 2.5 because it's a two-parter.
Let me point out
Angelo's.
Yep. Let me point out about episode one.
Yes.
That you, because you're a vegetarian,
yep,
did not have a hot wiener.
That is correct.
And so they made for you a vegetarian hot wiener that was a colossal failure.
It was a colossal failure. Yeah, they a good sometimes innovation doesn't work. That's right. They might want to invest in you know, some sort of veggie dog that they can flavor that with their stuff if they're going to go that direction.
Or you can just change.
That's true. That's true as well. Break the cycle here and enter back into the meat consumption zone. I paid the price for the veggie dog, which was literally a roll or a bun with every condiment on it times like five, you know.
It was funny. Yeah,
something else.
I think that the fill-in guys is, you know, a really cool thing that we're doing. We're two guys from different eras. And don't say anything. you know, we come at things a little bit differently. We typically get to the same point, I think, place, ultimately. But I thought it would be fun. And, you know, we talked to Greg Stevens at the New York System in episode one. And we are in the midst of parts one and two with the Attorney General, who loves Angelo's. And part one was pretty cool. And I'm looking forward to part two, which is scheduled to come out in a week or so, I think.
I think so,
And, you know, we have other great guests in the hopper, but I think that we're going to wait until we can actually go and be in the restaurant.
I would say so. I mean, it's kind of pointless to do it virtually. It is pointless to do it virtually. The whole experience is based on in person. And look, today we're going to find out what phase two looks like, and who knows? You know, I think it's really tough to predict anything here. There's the petition going around right now, 170 restaurants looking for a June 1st indoor dining reopening. You know, it's tough to say whether or not that's even remotely feasible. At the same time, that's a good target date to then say, okay, well, we can move 2 to 4 weeks away from that June 1st date and still be somewhere close to that goal, if you will.
I think we have to be careful about what we wish for also. There's a delicate balance and a delicate dance going on between what is prudent and what is just what you desire. And we're going to know soon enough whether this great reentry is, you know, has been wise or not. Because we're going to see it in terms of both the infection rates and, you know, the potential shutdowns. And we're going to see it not only in other states, we're going to see it here. So, you know, as I've said, my fingers are crossed that we're doing it the right way, but we're not going to know until we're actually through the period where we've started to integrate back into a process of some sort.
David Dedakin writes again that it's not a petition, it's a letter to guests. And that is a significant difference. But, you know, I think the way it's being perceived right now, by and large, is that, you know, that there's restaurants who are saying, and I believe, I know Olneyville New York System is on that letter, that, look, we need to get back to business to be able to sustain with any kind of serious thought that we're going to be able to carry forward anything close to what we were doing before or even at all. And that's that delicate balance. You know, as a musician, you know, I saw Ballard's on Block Island announced they're having a show on June 12th. I mean, that's outrageous. Yeah. You know, that's completely irresponsible. I even interviewed the musician who's involved in that. I'm thinking, what are you doing? You know, why would you, you know, why would you, why not wait for more evidence from restaurants, you know, 15 person groups? And why would you pack in hundreds of people even onto a beach and perform? But at the same time, you know what, if it, again, going back to that sort of libertarian element of it, it's going to be on everyone's shoulders to say, hey, look, we need to decide for ourselves how we're going to handle this. And I'm not going to perform, but if someone else wants to perform or go to a show, I guess that's on them.
Here's the rub on that, right? As I've said, I'm all for people making their own choices. I happen to have a lot of friends who are on the front lines, you know, on the medical front lines, and they're telling me that they wouldn't do it. Now, you can either follow the guidance of science and medicine or not. That's your decision. So if the government says you can go do a certain thing and you decide to go do it, that's on you. The rub in this is that we all share a responsibility in terms of the stress and the pressure on the healthcare system. Ultimately, we can't have it both ways, right? We can't have it both ways. And this whole thing has been about the healthcare system. It's been about not putting an overwhelming burden that could not be serviced on that system. And luckily, that did not happen. At least heretofore, it did not happen. But as we have been warned over and over and over again, we have to be careful. So I understand fully that there are restaurateurs, and I'd be interested in David Dedekian's comments on this, that want to go full bore. And some of them are my friends. You know, okay, but what if it's a failed experiment, or, you know, what if it's a successful experiment? Then what? What is, you know, what do we do at that point?
Absolutely. And then there's the other aspect of it that's very practical, which is, let's say I have my friend in Newport Salvation Cafe, Sue Lamond. Let's say she invested in a tent. She invested in heaters for an outdoor space. You know, she's investing in, and believe me, that's in the several thousands of dollars, perhaps getting even into five figures. Now, all of a sudden, you have to move backwards again. And, or, you know, essentially that this period here, this interloping period could end up being a huge expense that doesn't pan out. And, you know, what is that like for someone?
Well, you know, I know a little bit about the economic model of a restaurant. So if you spend 20 bucks in a restaurant, the net profit on that is maybe $2 or $2.50. So you think about the volume necessary to support the existing infrastructure, which is the equipment, the people cooking, and, you know, just the stuff that you take for granted, the knives, the forks, and all, you know, all that stuff. Now you add on to it the level of complexity that we've talked about, the PPE, the new tables, the plexiglass dividers, all this stuff. You know, now you're talking real money, and you're talking about loans. You're talking about, you know, perhaps raising prices. So it takes a lot of intestinal fortitude to be in that business. You know, and a lot of people think it's glamorous. And to some extent, it may be, but by and large, it's just a bunch of good people trying to make a living, putting out good food, and building a clientele. And it's because they love it. They love doing what they do. So if you're able to support in any way, whether it's takeout or in restaurant dining, or whatever it is, if you're able to do it, do it.
Absolutely. And David actually wrote in that he hasn't spoken to anyone that wants to go full bore right now. It's more about having target dates.
Yeah.
So owners know how long they have to set up,
yeah,
and how much to spend on the tents, the barriers, and et cetera, to get there.
It's my hope, Bill, that that all the smart people that are in the position of making decisions, David, Dale, the governor, the leadership, economic development, Stefan and his team, it is my hope that they are working collaboratively, that they are truly trying to get to a place that not only saves this industry, but makes it even a more thriving, more successful industry by reimagining things that perhaps they didn't before.
Absolutely. And I just got a press release right here from Mayor Alorza that just came in a second ago. There's going to be free parking now at Wells Avenue, Spruce Street, Dean Street, looking at Broad Street, Hope Street, et cetera, Thayer. So, you know, even right there, there's a little bit of effort going into just making this a little bit easier. I mean, the last thing we need is people getting tickets while they're inside, you know, these experiences.
But, you know, also that we all have to, you know, if we don't follow rules, there's just anarchy, right? And so it's up to us to follow the rules, even if we don't agree with them, until the rules change. And if you think that you're more special than someone else, you're just contributing to the problem.
And wrapping this section up before we get into your Ken Burns activity, Michael writes, without spending, there are no sales. Without sales, there are no profits. Without profits, there's no demand for workers. Without demand for workers, there's no job creation. Booyah.
Yeah. Bingo. Yeah, he's absolutely right. That's 100%. A t-shirt.
That is right there. That's get rid of knock it off, you know, the summer edition coming up right there. Just that on a hat.
Right.
And by the way, he also writes, without job creation, there's no recovery. Couldn't be more accurate on that front. So
that's for sure.
All right. So another wrench that was kind of thrown into your plans was something I was looking forward to going to watch the premiere of your Ken Burns or your documentary on Ken Burns at Rhode Island PBS. That obviously has been postponed, but let's talk about that project. I mean, that's an amazing project. I know for sure. I mentioned that to my wife, who's a RISD student. She was like, really? I mean, does he know him? And I was like, yeah.
So I'm pleased to say that, it will premiere. Its national premiere will be on June 22nd on Rhode Island PBS. And, I'm really excited about that. So it has been a project that is a labor of love for me. And I've known Ken for a long time, and he continually said no to my idea. And then one day he said yes, and we did it. And so my little ragtag band of filmmakers spent a lot of time with Ken, and we put together what I think is a beautiful little one-hour documentary on Ken that's never been done before. It's really an insight into who he is as a person who is shaped by his place, where he lives in large part, and that he is shaped by the people around him, the places around him, and had he not been in his town of Walpole, New Hampshire, had he not found Walpole, New Hampshire, we may not have seen sort of the incredible creative output that he's given us over the past over 40 years now. You know, he made the Brooklyn Bridge, his Academy Award nominated first documentary, on a shoestring budget, but he wasn't able to finish the film. So if you think in terms of metaphorically the film canisters on top of the refrigerator, you know, waiting for the money to kind of finish it, had he not been able to find Walpole and be able to live more inexpensively there and use that money to finish the film, Ken Burns, the greatest documentary filmmaker in the world, would never have been. So we explore that. The name of the film is Ken Burns Here and There, which is both about place and a state of mind. We're really pleased. My collaborator is Eric Latek. I think you know Eric, who is an incredible force of creative nature. And I also used David Sabatka on lighting and additional videography, and the great Mauro Colangelo did a completely extraordinary music score for this. And there's been a lot of reviews of the film so far, and heretofore they've all been pretty great. I'm humbled, and I can't wait for the world to see it.
I can't wait to see it, honestly. You know, it's really something that I'm looking forward to. And also, you know, I was looking forward to the in-person premiere. Is that going to happen? Is that on schedule mentally?
Probably not, but potentially I have a few more things in the pipeline of a national scope. So hopefully one of those, but we may do something with Ken. Who knows?
Dante Bellini Jr., ladies and gentlemen, it's the Fill-In Guys. You can search on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Joe Rogan just announced like a multi-million dollar deal to put his podcast exclusively on Spotify. So maybe we should be pushing people to Spotify all of a sudden here. You know, look out.
Yeah, yeah. Your lips to God's ears.
Yeah. That's a lot of ravioli and eggplant parmesan for me. That's for sure over at Angelo's.
That's right, Bill. You're doing a great job. Rhode Island is really, I think, blessed to have you and have an offering like you out there, giving us a breakdown of complex issues comprehensively, being everywhere, and doing it with great elegance, I think, Bill.
I'm humbled to hear that, especially from you as someone that I admire greatly professionally and, you know, very much so appreciate that.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Well, have a great rest of your day. I am going to post this, go to a press conference and keep this computer turned off for the next 3 days. So
I hope so.
Yeah. Happy Memorial Day out there. Right. You know,
see you, man.
See you.
Be good.
You too.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Discover over 200 episodes of the Bartholomew Town Podcast, Rhode Island's podcast of record, at ripodcast.com, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to listen. And also, be sure to check out The Fill-In Guys, Episode 1 from Olneyville, New York System, and Episode 2 from Angelo's on Federal Hill.